Thanks very much, Helen. I'd like to welcome everyone on my own account, but I'd like to extend a particular welcome to our keynote speaker, David Damrosch. David is a graduate of comparative literature at Yale. He taught at Columbia University in New York from 1980 until 2009, when he was appointed professor of comparative literature at Harvard. He's a past president of the American Comparative Literature Association. No one has done more, I think, than David to develop debate about the implications for comparative literature of globalization. And his chief publications in this regard are What is World Literature, published by Princeton in 2003, The Buried Book, The Loss and Rediscovery of the Great Epic of Gilgamesh, published by Holt in 2007, and How to Read World Literature, published by Wiley-Blackwell in 2008. He's the founding general editor of the six-volume Longman Anthology of World Literature, now in its second edition, etc., etc. In a globalized age where people, goods, and cultural products transcend the boundaries of geography and time as never before, it's natural, of course, that literary studies turn their attention to the notion of world literature, exploring the ways in which literary analysis can be enriched by looking at the border-crossing itineraries followed by migrants, writers, texts, and translators. Without translators, there would be no world literature. And the focus of David's talk is precisely translation and world literature. David.
Thank you very much indeed to Brian for this very kind invitation. I'm very delighted to be here my first time in Australia. As I thought about what might be interesting to talk today, I decided to somewhat reverse direction from what I've thought of before about works becoming world literature by circulating out, typically in translation, from their home environment globally. I'll talk a little bit about globalization, but in particular I'm interested in thinking the other direction of how world literature functions in translation within national spaces. And I think I've been thinking lately about the kind of sort of a figure ground reversal, really, between the nation and the world, insofar as no national literature has ever developed, almost never, in isolation from a broader regional and often world context, so therefore the nation exists within the world. But in any given literary space, world literature exists largely in terms of what's available in translation within a national market. So actually, world literature is experienced almost entirely within national borders, within the national language to which translators bring these works from around the world. So I thought I'd think a little bit about some implications of this. And my claim today would be that literary scholars to the extent this is acknowledged in theory, is rarely followed through in practice as to what it really means to think of the national literature as including on some equal plane translated works that circulate within the nation as well as the so-called originals that exist. And I think this we're seeing a kind of still lingering heritage of the long-standing, century-old antagonism between the study of world literature and the study of comparative literature in disciplinary terms and of national literatures. The world literature has been kind of caught outside of the dialogue of the national and the comparative since the 19th century, often relegated to very low-level first year of undergraduate courses, survey courses, taught entirely in translation typically, and outside the real business of literary studies, which was always thought to be in the national language, either the monolingual study within a national literature department or the comparative study of two or three literatures in comparative literature. I think that when I came to graduate school in the mid-70s, the mark of being a comparatist was having a really good accent in French and German. whatever else you did, that was how you knew you were a comparatist. Plus, and in my case, also English. And you might do a little bit of Russian, or you might do Renaissance Italian or something, or classics, and that was about it, right? And so the comparatists, as that field grew up in the 19th century, in the heyday of European nationalism, more or less gave in or bought into and played up the then quite new and relatively tendentious association of the nation with the national language, even though if one really steps back, of course, there are very few, if any, languages that are coextensive with a national border. I mean, it's very hard to think of what that would be. There are Hungarian speakers in Romania. There are other languages spoken in Hungary. You can't even say a relatively small language like that is coextensive with anyone. Border, which has shifted anyway over the centuries, you know, German speakers and so on. And of course, what you had with that creation there of the artifice of the national language is not only the regularization of language towards usually a metropolitan center version of the language, but then also the active suppression of other languages, such as Welsh or Irish, say, in the British Isles, which are not allowed to be part of the national space. So what one might ask today, well, in this globalized world, how adequate is the category of the national language at all, or of the national literature? Should that be simply seen as being superseded today? We can certainly, and what would it mean to think of the role of translation in a national space if it's doing something other than being the kind of evil twin of the true study of the essence of literature in its natural, original language. In particular, of course, we think of this a lot these days in terms of the kleine Literaturen, or the less spoken languages that may exist within a national space, whether Aboriginal languages, whether languages of immigrants or so on, whether the small countries in a larger region, very striking how the opening out to a multilingual world reshapes something like Europe, which so often had been so seen in such limited terms in, for example, world literature courses. Even when those courses were in translation, typically for a long time, those courses would track the limited number of languages that the comparatists at the graduate level were doing in the original. So you have, for example, in 1960, the Swiss-American emigre Werner Friedrich, who was a professor of the University of North Carolina and founder of the Yearbook of Comparative and General Literature, he was criticizing American courses in world literature for false advertising, for having so little of the world. Even though they were in translations, when in principle they might have. In fact, they were hewing very close to the major cultures, major Western European cultures. As he noted, these courses were not even trying to cover all of Europe, much less the whole world. He says in his essay of 1960, apart from the fact that such a presumptuous term as world literature makes for shallowness and partisanship, which should not be tolerated in a good university, is simply bad public relations to use this term and to offend more than half of humanity. Sometimes in flippant moments, I think we should call our programs NATO literatures. Yet even that would be extravagant, for we do not usually deal with more than one-fourth of the 15 NATO nations, as there were then. Not that Werner Friedrich was advocating enlarging the field. On the contrary, he proposed abolishing the term world literature altogether. A decade later, the German comparatist, Horst Rüdiger, offered a strong defense of a major power comparatism, now by a negative analogy to the United Nations. Comparative literature, he wrote, must not be seen as eine Vollversammlung der UNO, in der die Stimme der Großmächte so viel zählen wie die der politischen Provinz. So the small countries aren't even countries, they're political provinces. That's all they get to be. Instead, comparative literature is der liebe, aureus, der tätig geglückten und historisch wirksamen Werke der Literatur in allen Sprachen. So he says all languages, but in fact, in his study, he speaks only of French, German, and English writers and a couple of classics. So all languages turn out, in fact, to be the usual suspects. Those suspects that he could read in the original and would not have to deal with in translation. This, the comparative literature of my generation, had no courses in translation theory at Yale University or translation practice, undergraduate or graduate level, because you were not supposed to use them. You were not supposed to know they existed, right? That whole kind of thing. So we can welcome the degree to which this has opened up, and yet old habits of mind die hard. And even the most intelligent readers will somehow repress the fact they are reading translations. At least I have possibly benefited, but I think not necessarily so much benefited, by the fantastic assumption of my readers that I have a much better linguistic command of the world's languages than in fact I have. Not only that they fantasize what I myself fantasize, which is I'm actually fluent in languages I've studied somewhat, but they seem to even suppose a greater level of fluency than in any way they might. So this book of mine on what is world literature, on the very back of the book, one of the blurbs for it by Vlad Gozic, meaning very well, who'd read the whole book, he seemed to have, praises the book for treating its subjects from Aztec poetry to Spanish protest novels with equal erudition and philological accuracy, not noting that I have an entire chapter on a Serbian novel and I don't read a word of Serbian. I make no claim of reading a word of Serbian. It is, in fact, read in translation. I talk about the translation. The chapter is about the translation of Pavic's novel. And Vlad assumes I've read it in the original. I have not read the translation. It's the subject of the goddamn chapter. Right? Pardon me. I get worked up about this because what the translator's invisibility is also the scholar's invisibility talking about it. It's the subject, right? I mean, you know, we know the problem. But that the blurb from my own book misses, you know, this. So, you know, it does me, you know, much too much credit to suppose, you know, okay, when I'm writing about Kafka, I can talk about, you know, his style in the original in a way that I cannot talk about Milorad Pavic. I'm sorry. So, you know, and this suggests a kind of habit of mind or fantasy of linguistic mastery that simply goes along with the sidelining of serious study of translation so often, or serious account for it. So to think today about the vital role of translation within national literatures is to me the next beachhead in this battle. It seems to me to think not just that the world literature is the thing that's in translation outside the work of national literature or comparative literature, but that actually it is the part of the very fabric and substance of the national literature. That means to think differently than people thought about world literature from the time of Goethe onwards. As Goethe popularizes the phrase in 1827, speaking to his young disciple Johann Peter Ackermann, he thinks of Weltliteratur as the coming literature of the modern age, an age he envisions as virtually post-national. Nationalliteratur, he says, will jetzt nicht viel sagen. Die Epoche der Weltliteratur ist an der Zeit, und jede muss jetzt dazu wirken, diese Epoche zu beschleunigen. Right? The national literature doesn't mean anything anymore. We're on the cusp of the age of world literature. We have to work to forward it. But in a sense, I also want to agree with him that actually national literature is now world literature. World literature is now national literature in a very profound way. Goethe was already understanding that literature gains its meaning in circulation with other countries. Although, also in his case, in a mixture of reading in the original, he read in about six languages, so rather like George Eliot, and in translation. You know, I talk about in the What Is World Literature book how significant it is. He's reading a Chinese novel in English translation, and he's reading Serbian poetry in German translation at the same time that he's formulating his concept. But it's also noteworthy that Goethe had no embarrassment about translation. And I think probably no one ever thought translation was a metaphysical problem before the rise of the modern nationalism with the assumption of a kind of mystical essence of the national language that could not be translated. Goethe talks to Ackermann about how much more he's enjoying reading Faust in French than in German. He finds it fresher and livelier reading it in French, relating, of course, to the cultural prestige of French, and he's very happy now to be going upmarket, to be read in French, and to see himself, you know, widerspiegelt in French is quite wonderful. There's even a great phrase. I think pass it over. Or have I come to it? He says, "Yes." An jede Literatur ennuiert sich zuletzt in sich selbst, wenn sie nicht durch fremde Teilnahme wieder aufgefrischt wird. So every literature sort of becomes weary, it becomes bored of itself if it's not refreshed from outside, but uses a French loan word to say that, ennuiert. seems very appropriate. So now if we start to think about these transnational processes that shape the national, the most obvious thing is that no national literature arises on its own, with the possible exception of Sumerian literature in the Old Babylonian period, because no one else knew how to write at that point. But already by the Middle Babylonian period, you're already dealing with a multilingual and transnational world as the Babylonian grows up in biofeedback with the Egyptians, who have also learned how to write at this time, and the multiple languages being spoken in the Mesopotamian Valley. King Shulgi of Ur, the world's first patron of literature, praises himself for being fluent in five languages. So this is already a complete multilingual world. And translation starts between Sumerian and Akkadian in the Middle Babylonian period, back and forth. You also have already then some of the same imbalances of translation. We know long afterwards, translation is largely downstream in terms of cultural power. There's a lot of translation from Sumerian into Akkadian, from Akkadian into Hittite and Aramaic. There is no surviving translation from Hittite and Aramaic up into Akkadian or Sumerian. These imbalances were already there long before Larry Venuti found them with American literature. So we need to understand the national tradition as shaped by these transnational forces. But I want to emphasize a kind of biofeedback loop that goes back and forth that also shapes the presence of world literature within the nation. I think until recently, we've had a kind of... shell game between the nation and the language, in which that sort of police the internal external boundaries of literature. Often our courses carry on reflexively and unthinkingly the equation of the national language with the nation, so that English literature was defined linguistically as literature written in English. No Irish or Welsh need apply. And in the United States, until recently, American Literature Survey courses never included anything written in Spanish or French or Yiddish or Navajo. They just weren't there. It had to be Anglo. Conversely, however, in reaching the nation's borders, suddenly language is no longer the definition of the literature. It suddenly becomes geographic rather than linguistic, and so British literature is separated off from American literature or Caribbean literature or Australian literature. In many regions, the geographic imperative could then influence language in turn. If the language was too obviously transnational, the narcissism of small differences could be played up to turn quite similar languages into quite separate languages, so the Danish and Norwegian emerge as separate languages, separate from Icelandic and so on. In the 20s, H.L. Mencken becomes a best-selling author for his jingoistic study, The American Language, which no one had realized before was an American language. And, of course, ongoing in the 1980s, Serbo-Croatian becomes dismembered into two now separate antagonistic languages. But even today, we're just beginning to do justice to the true transnationalism of our national literary communities. So I'd like to give some examples here of what might happen if we reconceive national literatures seriously, not based on a fatherland's Muttersprache or on the passports of the authors, but on works' effective presence within a nation's literary culture. So we've always recognized the presence of a few favored migrant authors within a national literary space. T.S. Eliot is regularly included in anthologies of British literature and of American literature, quite justifiably. Why not? Though he was born and raised in St. Louis and received crucial intellectual formation during his years at Harvard, he made his career in England and even became a British citizen, exerting a tremendous influence in British literary life through his editorial work, his poetry, and his criticism. Yet what of Marie de France? Though this major medieval writer also made her career in London, drew heavily on British themes, Arthurian themes, for her lay, for many decades she remained a wholly owned subsidiary of French departments, simply because she wrote in Anglo-Norman and not Anglo-Saxon or Middle English. And this despite the fact that her very name means Marie from France, a name that no French author writing in France would ever have had. She would have been Marie de Paris, Marie d'Orléans, not Marie de France. That's not a meaningful name for a French author. Now, England's literary historical monolingualism was never actually total. Thomas More's Utopia was written in Latin and published in Holland, but it's always been understood as part of English literature, as has been the King James Version of the Bible, a masterpiece of prose. But this exclusion was quite something. I've often thought that if you know, and I'm very interested in translation and in the great wealth of medieval Welsh poetry, and I've always often thought, which I've included in my British anthology for the first time, I think, in any modern American survey anthology for undergraduates. So we have Welsh and Irish, and we have Marie de France, who had never been in an American anthology of British literature before. But I've often thought that if Merlin had been, or say if Taliesin or Dafydd Ap Gwilym, one of my favorite Welsh poets, had been blessed with Merlin's gift of prophecy and wanted to be in the Norton Anthology of English Literature 1,000 years later, he should have written in Latin rather than Welsh, even though Welsh was and still is a spoken language, unlike Latin to this day. But these exceptions allowed, like Moore's Utopia, have been rather few and far between. If we think less about national languages and more about national markets, attending to what is actually read in a given time and place, even in the national language, we are suddenly in a much more international world of the nation. Cervantes was far more widely read in 18th century England than was Chaucer, for example, let alone Beowulf, whose sole surviving manuscript had yet to be discovered by a visiting Icelandic scholar seeking Scandinavian material. It is no coincidence that Laurence Sterne's opinionated hero Tristram Shandy, speaking of his favorite authors, does not name Chaucer or Defoe, but instead praises my dear Rabelais and my dear Cervantes. It was actually that line in Tristram Shandy, which I read when I was 15, that made me a comparatist. I thought, well, if that's who he likes, I better read that. And, of course, he was reading certainly Cervantes in translation, probably Rabelais as well. Translations, as one English translator noted in 1654, swarm more than ever. And from the 16th century through the 18th, Spanish and French romances and plays would often have outnumbered homegrown productions in London booksellers' shops. Their plots, themes, and imagery made their way into English language writing in much the same way as local material would do, adopted by writers who did not cordon off translated works in some separate mental folder from English language originals. In this connection, it may be recalled that Moore's Utopia is indebted not only to Plato's Republic, but also to the peninsular literature of travel and exploration. Moore casts his narrative in the form of conversations in Antwerp with Rafael Hislo Dias, a Portuguese sailor who has traveled to Brazil with Amerigo Vespucci and then branched out on his own to discover Utopia. Beginning in the colonial period, the transatlantic book trade reinforced the interplay of the local and the foreign within the European and the nascent American national traditions. I'd like to propose that an influential colonial author such as Bartolomé de las Casas should be seen at once as part of American and of European literature, both British and Spanish. In the original Spanish, his Brevísima Relación de la Destrucción de las Indias of 1552 is a major work of colonial Mexico and the Caribbean. In English translation, it circulated in England and in the American colonies during the 16th and 17th centuries with direct literary as well as political results. Of particular interest is the second English translation, published in 1656, translated by John Phillips, who was an also early translator of Don Quixote. He undertook the translation of Las Casas at the request of his uncle, John Milton, who had paid for his education, treating him almost as an adopted son. Though the Brevísima Relación had been translated several decades before, a new version would be useful to Oliver Cromwell as he sought to counter Spanish hegemony in the New World. Having failed to do so by direct action, the Spanish had soundly defeated a fleet that Cromwell sent to the Caribbean in 1654. 2 years later, Cromwell turned to textual means, or even the next year. In 1655, he published a declaration of His Highness by the advice of his council setting forth the justice of their cause against Spain, a tract which Milton translated into Latin for foreign consumption. Soon afterwards, presumably of Milton's advice, his nephew John Phillips was commissioned to retranslate Las Casas as part of the propaganda effort to highlight the evils of Spanish misrule. In an illuminating article on toleration and translation, Elizabeth Sauer notes that in the introduction to his translation, Phillips echoes language that his uncle had employed in his observations on the cruelties of the Irish, a tract that Milton had written in support of Cromwell's violent suppression of the Irish Rebellion of 1641. Now, to the modern eye, England's Irish subjects might seem more readily parallel to the American Indians than to the conquistadores, but to Milton and to Cromwell, the common term was Catholicism. And they sought to combat the insidious spread of the power of the papacy in the Holy Roman Empire, then governed by Spain's monarchs. In translating the Brevissima Relación, Phillips played up the human drama of the Spanish practices denounced by Las Casas. The destruction of the Indies, the region, becomes in his translation the Tears of the Indians, which is what it's called. And on his title page, Mexico is subordinated to the large type West Indies, which is the area of primary English concern at the time. The translations illustrated lurid images, giving a kind of pornography of violence, showing conquistadors hacking apart body parts, almost like Aztec cannibalism going on, really sort of striking, with infernal imagery of fire and devilry. And the persistent imagery of fire in a lot of the illustrations to the English translation strengthened the association between the conquistadores and the devil's infernal henchmen, visually echoing Phillips's preface, which declares that, and I quote, "It hath been the satanical scope of the tyrant to set all European provinces at variance, to keep them busy at home, that they might not have leisure to bend their forces against his golden regions." Furthering the satanic theme, the strong body parts in the pictures associate the Spanish with the cannibalistic Aztec priests, widely viewed as minions of the devil in his guise of the war god Huitzilopochtli. One Spaniard is even shown cutting the heart out of his dismembered victim, Aztec style. The overall effect of Phillips' presentation in his translation, as well as the illustrations, is very different from that of the Spanish original. For all of the severity of Las Casas' critique of the conquistadores' successes, his was a plea for reform within the Spanish imperial project. In Phillips' hands, the book became something very different, a wholesale denunciation of Spanish rule, even of Catholic culture at large, a radical revision that would have shocked Las Casas himself. If John Phillips drew in his uncle's tracts in framing his translation, the Tears of the Indians became a resource for Milton in turn, inflecting his portrayal of Satan in Paradise Lost. A decade later, often seen in terms of classical paganism, Milton's Satan is closely associated as well with Catholic imperialism. In Book 4 of Paradise Lost, Satan voyages from hell to the boundless continent of Earth, where he hopes to increase his, quote, honor and empire with revenge enlarged by conquering this new world. The Tears of the Indians, John Phillips' title there, come to the fore as Adam and Eve contemplate their fallen bodies and their new sewn clothing. Oh, how unlike to that first naked glory, such of late Columbus found the American so girt with feathered cincture, naked else and wild among the trees on isles and woody shores. Thus fenced, and as they thought their shame in part covered, but not at rest of, or ease of mind, they sat them down to weep, nor only tears rained at their eyes, but high winds worse rose within, worse within began to rise, high passions, anger, hate, mistrust, suspicion, discord. The tears of Adam and Eve, brought about by Hispanized Satan, are the mirror image of the tears of the Indians caused by Phillips' satanic Spanish monarch, sower of discord in Europe in order to keep his rivals away from his new world possessions. As Elizabeth Cyrus says, the dialectical process of England's identity formation was decisively shaped through its religious, cultural, political, and economic relations with Spain. Textual representation, appropriation, and translation serve as vital but neglected forms of nationhood. That's Sauer. In this perspective, the Tears of the Indians should be considered as much an English as a Spanish work. In fact, an English work rather than a Spanish work. It's a completely different work. Significantly refrained by Phillips in tone and cultural political intent for his English audience. And quite appropriately on the title page, it says, written in Spanish by Casaos, an eyewitness of their things, of these things, and made English by J.P. It doesn't say translated, it says made English. How true. Such national reframing often happens at the hands of a work's foreign translators and publishers, but it can be accomplished directly by authors themselves. And here I want to think of kind of internal translation across the two cultures divided by a single language, England and America, to take Dylan Thomas's phrase. A good illustration being a modern author who crossed the Atlantic repeatedly, like Las Casas before him, no longer in the service of empire, but to cultivate his dual readerships in England and America. I refer here to P.G. Woodhouse, who shuttled back and forth between London and New York in the 20s and 30s to assist in productions of his plays and to keep up his contacts with British and American publishers. particularly, and there's a lot, there's all kinds of stuff both about global English in his works, and I've written about that in my world literature book, but also about French. He was living in France for a number of years, and one of his great novels involved two characters in France opposing as Frenchmen. It's somewhat difficult for them because they don't speak French, so it's, but they manage to get by. But particularly relevant for the transnational national theme is Woodhouse's 1926 story, The Clicking of Cuthbert, which directly illustrates the co-creation, I think, of the national and the international. In the story, a gloomy Russian novelist named Vladimir Brusilov is making a lecture tour in America. His gloom profoundly deepened by the fact that at every step, he's assailed by ambitious, indistinguishable young novelists who insist on reading their manuscripts to him. So here we have the author of world literature within the national space coming to reception at a literary club hosted by a suburban society matron, Mrs. Smethurst. Vladimir Brusilov rebuffs all attempts at sociability, his natural taciturnity increased by his discomfort with English. Widow says he gave the impression that each word was excavated from his interior by some up-to-date process of mining. The hero of the story is Cuthbert Banks, a talented golfer, a recent winner of the French Open, but someone with no interest at all in literature. He's only come to this grim soiree in hopes of impressing Mrs. Smethurst's niece, Adeline. She, however, is smitten with an up-and-coming young literary lion, Raymond Parsloe Devine, whose literary career is being made on his ability to imitate translations of foreign novels. Significantly, Adeline informs Cuthbert that Devine's claim to fame is how European he is. "Mr. Devine," replied Adeline, blushing faintly, "is going to be a great man. Already he has achieved much. The critics say he is more Russian than any other American writer." "Is that good?" "Of course it's good. I should have thought," says the innocent Cuthbert, "that the wheeze would be to be more American than any other young American writer." "Nonsense. Who wants an American writer to be American? You've got to be Russian or Spanish or something to be a real success." Interestingly, and I take this, it's really interesting, it registers the importance of translation in American culture, satirically, but that's, you know, that's the prodigious stuff. Interestingly, Woodhouse continues to register here the long reach of peninsular prestige that had Sir Thomas More and Lawrence Stern before him. You have to be Russian or Spanish or something. In fact, in expecting an American writer to be Spanish or something, Adeline is vaguely recalling a recent talk at her mother's club on the neo-Portuguese movement in Scandinavian literature. Woodhouse has a perfect ear. Apparently, there was the original Portuguese movement in Scandinavian literature. Now there's a neo-Portuguese movement in Scandinavian literature. A perfect Woodhousean touch. So Raymond Parsloe Devine, the young Russian-Spanish-American, is confident that he will shine before the visiting Russian. So he waxes eloquent in praise of the novelists Nastikoff and Sovietsky. Yet he has not reckoned with the fact that, like many writers, Brusilov hates all of his national rivals. He admires only the safely dead Tolstoy. Brusilov roundly declares, "I spit me of Sovietsky, Nastikoff no good." And then in a startlingly metafictional moment, he reveals that the only contemporary writer he esteems is P.G. Woodhouse himself. "P.G. Woodhouse and Tolstoy, not bad. Not good, but not bad." Humiliated, young Raymond Parsloe Devine retreats in shame. "It is too much to say there was dead silence," the narrator observes. "There could never be that in any room in which Brusilov was eating cake." The way is now clear for Cuthbert to make his mark on the gathering and thereby win the girl's admiration. But lacking any literary knowledge, Cuthbert is at a loss to enter in the conversation. But then Brusilov asks a question, and here we get into dialect issues of global English or Russian-American English and cultural differences of England versus America. Brusilov asks a question that his cultured hostess cannot quite comprehend. Mrs. Smethurst has inquired whether he's met many prominent Americans during his lecture tour. And Brusilov mentions having met several, but then expresses his regret. "I have not met your real great men, your Waregin, your Bennigan. Have you ever met Waregin and Bennigan?" Mrs. Smethurst is ashamed that she doesn't recognize these names, apparently two American writers she's never heard of. How could this be? Her problem is partly linguistic. Brusilov's heavily accented English has mangled these names. But it's also cultural, for Mrs. Smethurst knows nothing of the cultural sphere that Brusilov has in mind. It turns out that Brusilov is a golfing enthusiast. And the mystery men are two of America's leading golfers of the 1920s, Walter Hagen and Ben Hogan. In the entire gathering, only Cuthbert knows their names. He diffidently steps forward to solve the riddle and mentions that he was partnered with Hagen in last year's Open. Finally, Brusilov comes to life, delighted to have met the famous Kutubut Banks, whose name he knows. And he takes Cuthbert aside to trade stories about putting. I'll give you this just for the pleasure of Woodhouse's play with multiple layers of English. You'll see he mixes technical golfing language, Americanisms, parodic Russian-Americanisms, all in one. "It was one day I played Nizhny Novgorod with the pro against Lenin and Trotsky. Trotsky had a 2-inch putt for the hole. But just as he addresses the ball, someone in the crowd tries to assassinate Lenin with a revolver. You know, that is a great national sport, trying to assassinate Lenin with a revolver. And the bang puts Trotsky off his stroke, and he goes 5 yards past the hole.
And then Lenin, who is rather shaken, you understand, he misses again himself. And we win the hole and the match, and I clean up 396,000 rubles, or $5 in your money.
So you notice this tremendous comic facility that Woodhouse has with the varieties of global English. Brusilov's Russian-American dialect, the revolver, which is one day I play, is leavened with British golfing language, just as he addresses the ball, and pure Americanisms I clean up. He can mix several dialects in a single outburst.
My dear young man, I saw you win the French Open. Great, great, grand, superb, hot stuff, and you can say I said so.
Brusilov's great compatriot Mikhail Bakhtin could hardly have found a better example of dialogistic heteroglossy in Dostoevsky himself. So I've long admired Woodhouse's skill at mixing varieties of global English, but I've only recently come to realize just how nationally specific this global world literature story is. On downloading a generous selection of Woodhouse's works onto my Kindle, I discovered that the mobile reference works of P.G. Woodhouse contains a very different British version of The Clicking of Cuthbert. In the British version, the story is not set in America, but in England, and Raymond Parsloe Devine's Russianness makes him more English than any other young English writer. This is surprising. Woodhouse regularly publishes books on both sides of the Atlantic, often with the new titles and adjusted spelling, but ordinarily a British setting stays British and American one stays American. Why change the national tradition? In the story, the plot hinges on Cuthbert's ability to disentangle Brusilov's slurred names, and the humor of the scene depends on the reader's amused recognition of the prominent golfers once Cuthbert decodes the Russian English. If we fail to recognize the golfers' names, we would be relegated to the embarrassing position of the clueless Mrs. Smethurst, a figure of mockery in the story, and Woodhouse always makes us happy as readers. He will never embarrass his reader. His commercial success relies on that. And evidently, Woodhouse felt he could not count on his readers on one side of the Atlantic to recognize the names of golfers on the other side. So in the English version, Brusilov inquires not about Vadogan and Bennigan, but about Arb Michel and Arivadon, whom Cuthbert now identifies as Abe Mitchell and Harry Vardon, two prominent British golfers of the age. So in the service of this local specificity, Woodhouse shifted his story across the Atlantic in whichever direction. I don't actually know which one was published first. Enrolling Raymond Parsloe Devine in his readers' respective national literary traditions. So it's clear that however faux Russian or neo-Portuguese Raymond Devine may be, the transatlantic Woodhouse himself was keenly aware of the national specificity of his different audiences. So The Clicking of Cuthbert is thus very clearly a work of British literature in one of its versions and a work of American literature in the other one, much as Las Casas Brevissima Oración becomes a British work in John Phillips's version. A T.S. Eliot in reverse, Woodhouse deserves to be considered an American as well as a British writer. He spent more years living in the United States than in England. He published widely in American magazines from 1915 onward and even became an American citizen. Yet to my knowledge, he's found exclusively in British literary guides and anthologies and never has been anthologized in an American literature anthology that I have ever seen. To see Woodhouse in this double way would already be an improvement over the narrow nationalism that's still far too prevalent in our literary studies. And this gets even worse when language comes even more directly in than the varieties of global English that we see with Woodhouse. From the time Lolita hit the bestseller list in the mid-1950s, Vladimir Nabokov has been recognized as an American writer as well as a Russian writer. American studies of Nabokov regularly take into account his earlier Russian language works as well, which themselves entered American literary culture when they were translated by Dmitri Nabokov under his father's watchful eye. Yet what of Marguerite Yourcenar, on whom I see there's going to be a talk at this conference? Like Woodhouse and Nabokov, she immigrated to the United States relatively early in her adulthood. She spent most of her working life in the U.S. She never shifted, however, from French to English, and she continued to set her novels and memoirs in Europe. It's understandable that European critics should emphasize her French or, at best, Belgian identity over her experience in her adopted country, but we misrepresent her work if we consider her exclusively as an eternal European. She moved to the United States in 1939. She lived in America for the dozen years preceding, during which she wrote and then published her master work, The Mémoires d'Adrien, published in 1951. Became international bestseller, sold 800,000 copies. A book she had begun years before in France, but then set aside, returning to it in 1949. So I've earlier argued that we shouldn't gauge the national literature simply by the writer's passport, but in fact, Yourcenar had become an American citizen in 1947. She was an American writer, legally speaking, when she composed her most famous work. She continued to live primarily in Northeast Harbor, Maine, until her death in 1987, 40 years later. Like Marie de France before her, she's been discussed almost exclusively by French scholars, who tend to treat her American sojourn as a charming aberration in a cultural wasteland that can have had no significant impact on her writing. Yet your Sonara not only lived with her American lover, Grace Frick, for 4 decades, but she also traveled widely in the United States, praising its expansive breadth to her friends. Quoting one of her letters, "If I were you, I would start by hitchhiking to San Antonio or San Francisco. It takes time to get to know this great country, at once so spread out and so secret." She collected African-American spirituals in the South. She translated volumes worth of them into French, published under the title Fleuve Profond, Sombre Rivière. She translated Henry James's What Maisie Knew into French, and later translated James Baldwin. These active relations to American literature and culture go largely undiscussed by Yourcenar's French critics. They might be discussed by her American critics, except there are no Americanists who've ever written about her, because she writes in French. That's the only reason. Yet it's likely that Yourcenar's American experiences enriched her meditations on Hadrian's far-flung empire, so much more American than French in its multicultural dimensions and its size. And probably informed in particular her hero's bemused tolerance of minority populations such as the Jews in Roman Judea. Living in Connecticut and teaching at Sarah Lawrence College as she worked on the memoirs, Yourcenar was surely gathering impressions from her students as well as information from the library at Yale University where she did her research. Even her relative disengagement from much of American culture can be seen as contributing to her Olympian portrayal of the Roman emperor. As Edmund White surely noted in a review of a recent biography of Yourcenar, Yourcenar's aloofness at Sarah Lawrence sounds remarkably like Vladimir Nabokov's at Cornell. Both Nabokov and Yourcenar, it may be noted, lectured on comparative literature at their respective colleges. And in the very years that Nabokov was gathering local color for Lolita at Cornell, Yourcenar was plotting out her universalized portrait of Hadrian in Connecticut and Maine. Her choice to settle in the United States, she later said, is not that of America against France. It translates a taste for a world stripped of all borders, a particularly American take on life at the time of works such as Kerouac's On the Road. In an afterword to Memoirs of Hadrian, Yourcenar wrote of resuming her long-abandoned novel while on a transcontinental road trip of her own by train in February 1949. Quoting her, "Closed inside my compartment as if in a cubicle of some Egyptian tomb, I worked late in the night between New York and Chicago, then all the next day in the restaurant of a Chicago station where I awaited a train blocked by storms and snow, then again until dawn alone in the observation car of a Santa Fe Limited, surrounded by black spurs of the Colorado Mountains and by the eternal pattern of the stars. Thus were written at a single impulsion the passages on food, love, sleep, and knowledge of men. I can hardly recall a day spent with more ardor or more lucid nights." Yourcenar was deeply sensitive to place. She became an environmental activist in her later years. In this passage, Yourcenar draws inspiration from the expansive American landscape, at once local and universal, surrounded by the black spurs of the Rockies and the eternal pattern of the stars, both linked to the landscape and separated from it, alone in an observation car of a Santa Fe Limited. Not long before Nabokov would work on Lolita while pursuing butterflies in Colorado, she continued to write her novel while touring New Mexico with Grace Frick. Her American experience inflected her novel on many levels, and the Memoir d'Adrien itself entered American literary space in turn when it was published in New York in 1954. It came out in the lucid translation lovingly prepared in Northeast Harbor by Grace Frick, corrected on a nightly basis by Yourcenar herself, who rightly or wrongly prided herself on possessing a greater command of English prose style than her American lover. The Memoirs of Hadrian received glowing reviews around the United States and stayed on the New York Times bestseller list for 20 weeks from December 1954 through May of 1955. It was eventually edged off the list by a varied group of American imported novels, including Françoise Sagan's Bonjour Tristesse, Thomas Mann's Confessions of Felix Krull, and very different in provenance and tone, Max Hyman's No Time for Sergeants. So an American, a French, and a German work edge off the Memoirs of Hadrian. Lolita was impressed during those very months, and it is not unreasonable to suppose that Nabokov was intrigued by his fellow émigré's portrayal of a philosopher king and his homosexual passion for his young lover, Antinous. The popular success of Hadrian's fictional memoir surely paved the way for Nabokov's next project, the tragicomic commentary memoir of the deposed Zemblin monarch, Charles X. Kinboat. So if the relatively isolated and inbred American literary space is so profoundly transnational, and so dependent on translation. This is all the more true of Europe, with its many closely connected countries, their literary capitals linked by networks of railways, highways, marriages and love affairs, book tours and book fairs. Yet even with writers whose binational identity is well recognized, the circulation of their work in European literary space is rarely given full attention. Consider the case of Eugene Ionesco. He is rightly identified as both a Romanian and a French writer, claimed by both countries. But a dual identification really isn't enough, because we have to think about the full circulation of his works in translation. They circulated widely in other national spaces in Europe. In important instances, in fact, his plays entered other European spaces even before they premiered in France, much less in Romania, which was usually with a lag of several more years. To take the case of his most famous play, Rhinoceros, it received its first performance in August of 1959 in the form of a broadcast in English by the BBC. His first full staging took place 2 months later in October 1959, again not in France, but in Dusseldorf in a German translation. So it appears first in English and then in German before it appears in French. Only in January 1960 did it receive its first French production. And even then it would be too simple to describe Rhinoceros as a purely French work. 3 months later it was performed simultaneously in French and in German. Over the course of 1960, it was also staged in England, directed by no less a figure than Orson Welles, also in Gdansk, in Prague, in Vienna, in Italy, in Oslo, and in Tokyo, just in 1960. Rhinoceros extended its transnational reach in the ensuing 2 years to Broadway, Greece, Israel, and Uruguay. Rhinoceros can thus be understood as a quintessentially European work, and even global, but primarily European in terms of its production, its circulation, and translations, circulating from the outset throughout European literary space and then more selectively elsewhere in the world. Equally, its highly individualized productions in these different countries contributed importantly to the various national spaces within which they were performed. So there's every reason to consider UNESCO as part of Italian as well as French literary culture today. La Cantatrice Chauve, inspired by UNESCO's surrealist reading of exercises in English grammar book, has established itself as a seemingly permanent fixture at the Théâtre de Huchette in Paris, where it's run continuously since 1957. Yet its Italian avatar, La Cantatrice Calva, is comparably prominent in Italian cultural space, having enjoyed more than 2,000 performances in Turin since 1958 and clearly becoming a major influence on Italian playwrights such as Nobel Prize winner Dario Fo. So, to conclude, examples as varied as Bartolome de las Casas, P.G. Woodhouse, Margaret Yourcenar, and Eugene Ionesco can suggest something of the international translational variety regularly to be found within our national literary communities. What such cases show is that the national and the global are by no means opposed cultural spheres. Instead, national literatures take on their full meaning when they seem to be shot through with the international. European literature is best understood as a product of a dynamic interplay of the international within the national and the national within the regional. Seen in their transnational global dimensions, the national traditions gain a new kind of distributed coherence, becoming a newly vital force field of study. Hot stuff, as Vladimir Brusilov would say, and you can say I said so. Thank you.
P.G. Woodhouse in that delightful way. I now invite questions and comments. We have some microphones here. I'm not quite sure whether they're necessary, but they are available.
Thank you. That was absolutely fascinating. Just one question. I was wondering about the place of oral literature. You started chronologically with Akkadian and Sumerian, which in their capacity as written languages. What would you do with oral literatures?
There, too, I think it's, particularly these days, of course, it's similar in that one would say that the national literary space would include things that circulate in whatever literary means, and in that sense, the older oral traditions, which were themselves profoundly transnational in complicated ways, are now supplemented by the circulation of material orally through world music, through film, through television. So in a certain sense, those, you could say, are non-written literary traditions that are now in other media. I'm one of the people who thinks that the Homeric poets got the idea of writing such composing such ambitious epics later written down by hearing performances of Akkadian epics. There are these really interesting overlays, so similar between elements of things like Gilgamesh and elements of the Iliad and the Odyssey. Not a direct translation. That's an interesting question about what does translation mean in oral culture. But there are scenes you can say, all right, surely someone heard this being performed in Akkadian and said, oh, I could do that myself in Greek. So it's never a translation line for line, but the Iliad starting out with the minor divinity, mother of the mortal hero, going to pray to the sun god on her son's behalf. it's a type scene. It's the same scene there. It seems likely and certainly known that bards who circulated in the Levant were often multilingual. So there's an interesting case there in which you could say the oral circulation already quite early on is jumping linguistic boundaries orally before it even gets written down. And something today like world music would be an extreme case of the oral circulation now across national boundaries and within national boundaries very much. Absolutely. I'm becoming strangely materialist in terms of the issues of circulation and how it really works. I'm myself a structuralist in recovery, I would say, old-style 70s, in which there weren't even authors. God forbid there should be books, in any real sense. Whereas now it seems to me this is absolutely the ground of understanding, and the kind of thing that Franco Moretti also does with a distant reading. Actually, you can do a very close reading. What is being published in a given time and place seems to me extremely important. And I could have given, I neglected to bring along a slide just to show the Las Casas, but the title pages are really interesting. The illustrations I talked about. You learn so much from seeing that. I think the material circulation is. That's why I think increasingly we think of the national market. It gets us out of the box of the national language. Even then, to think about the language itself as the market phenomenon. Not to deny that probably, I'm going to deny that, the home country language matters in some existential, ultimate, metaphysical way more than the most important works that you read in translation. Stern doesn't say that. There are very parochial language traditions like French where that's relatively true. But even that, for Proust, the Arabian Nights is extraordinarily important to him, the Mille et Une Nuits. So he's reading it in French as part of a French tradition, but it is bringing him stuff that he did not get from Flaubert. So I think very much. And self-translation becomes interesting indeed. I'm quite interested in Kipling, who I think is the first global, self-consciously global writer in our modern sense, that already when he was in his 20s, he knew he was being read in four or five continents and even published on at least four continents. And you see him move very, very fast from when he's about 19 or 20 years old. He's really a local Anglo-Indian writer. The departmental ditties and the plain tales for the hills are just written for these newspapers he was working for. It assumes a local audience and local knowledge. Within about 2 years, he suddenly realizes, all right, he's got to translate himself. And it has to do with literal self-translation of how he'll translate Hindi terms. And you see him experiment. He doesn't have any method worked out. It's so fascinating. There's no theory. He's just by the seat of his pants. Sometimes he'll translate something in parentheses. Sometimes he'll paraphrase. Sometimes he'll leave it untranslated because he has an instinctive sense that his readers want a certain amount of foreignness preserved. It's really, really interesting. And already by his mid-20s, he knows how to do this. And that's, I think, one reason he's so tremendously successful. So, yes, self-translation becomes extremely important, especially in the global age.
Teaching material or research material as much as reading and teaching in the national languages. Do you argue for a replacement of comparative literature with world literature? Is that the kind of tendency that you see in the last decade? I'm wondering about your thoughts about the concept of comparison and the concept of translation. and its place in our discipline.
That's absolutely crucial and directly the subject of a book I'm working on right now on this. I think it's an absolutely fascinating issue. I myself am very much a kind of a both-and kind of guy rather than either-or, and I do not believe that the study of literature should replace comparative literature as a discipline. My own department, we recently renovated our program at Harvard, and we're really keeping the term comparative literature as the name of the department. That's the name of the discipline. And I also think I would hate it if the study of world literature became the study only of translation and the loss of original, because you couldn't even have any more translation if you had the loss of deep knowledge of other languages. I mean, you know, translation requires deep knowledge of languages, and comparative literature should as well. So to me, the ideal world literature class, you read a hell of a lot of material in translation. You also read translations critically. In my world literature anthology, we now have units where you look at, you know, passages in three translations and say, now what is going on here, the translations of Voltaire or Euripides or Kalidasa. And the good world literature class should inspire a student to want to learn some new language they never even knew about. And one of the things that I think in the classroom is really, really interesting, if you look back, I quoted this guy, Werner Friedrich, from 1960, that was the first volume devoted to teaching world literature that I know about as a pedagogical thing, based on a conference in the Midwest, when it became very clear there was a really profound class and regional difference. They sort of apologize that they have really no scholars from the East Coast there, or from the coast. It's all from the West. But in fact, they have some scholars from the East Coast, just from large state schools. World literature courses in the 50s were being taught on a large basis at state schools, and the comparative literature programs at the elite schools rejected it. They didn't want it. They said, we are an elite discipline, and they start writing these reports on standards that are really saying, all right, you know, most colleges and even most universities can't actually have a serious comparative literature program because you have to have depth of national traditions. So they really pulled back. So you had the kind of populist Wisconsin type based, really it was, this conference wasn't Wisconsin, world literature in translation from a mass audience, and then you had the elite small complet thing. So I think what's really great is that breaks down and now there's an inter-animation. But comparative literature still has a very vital function. The study of national traditions, of literary traditions, of languages is extremely important. And I mean, just in my own case, it mattered a lot to me that I took an art history survey course as an undergraduate, as a freshman, that was just, you know, classic Greeks up to abstract expressionist course. But the guy who was assigned to teach my course was like an advanced graduate student. His field was Mesoamerican art, and he smuggled in a week on Mesoamerica just because he could. I decided to write my little term paper on an Aztec statue just because I thought it would be intriguing. And I was just a freshman. I wasn't doing serious research, but I looked around a little bit. I came on this book by Miguel León Portilla in English translation called Aztec Thought and Culture, which is actually an expanded version of what was in Spanish, La Filosofía Náhuatl. It's a better book in English, which is an interesting case. And he quoted a lot of the Aztec poetry as a way of getting into the thought world. And I thought, this is the most beautiful stuff that was so different from anything I'd ever read. I thought, if I ever get a chance, I'll study that language. And 4 years later in graduate school, I found a course in the anthropology department whose enrollment doubled when I signed up. My director of graduate studies threatened to defenestrate me when I asked for credit for this. And as the complete department there was on the 7th floor, it was a moment of vertigo. But he did give me credit for it in the end. So there's a case where just rapid, superficial survey of art history in the freshman year caused me to study a language. It's been very important to me afterwards. So I would like to think that. And one of the things that's really interesting about this conference volume from 1960 about the teaching of world literature, that they keep making gestures towards, well, you should bring in original text when you can. The assumption is entirely that the only one who knows a language is the professor and not the student. And what, I don't know, and I think you're probably finding this in Australia too, where I hear a lot about the growing multiculturalism of Australia. In the United States now, you'll find students who know so many more languages collectively than any one professor can. And one of the things that I've done now, for example, in my World Literature Survey course, I was having students do two short papers each semester. I now have them do one paper and one wiki. They'll work collaboratively on doing a little website thing, like a Wikipedia entry on one of the authors. And they do, this is very good as a strategy because they do so much more work for it than they'll do for the paper. I had a great wiki that had 274 footnotes, you know, from a sophomore. A great thing on Sanskrit. And you'll often find students will then suddenly reveal and bring to play knowledge that they had. So we had a great moment last year, where a student recited from memory in class a poem by Hafez, classical Persian. This is a student from the Dominican Republic. No heritage background whatsoever. He was just doing second-year Persian as a sophomore, somehow getting interested, and now he had learned a poem. It was such a matter of pride for him and joy. So I actually really think, this is a long answer, but that the good study of world literature will inspire more study of languages and different modes of comparison. So I think comparison is still a fundamental thing we do. We understand things by comparison and contrast. At the same time, my book on Gilgamesh was an entire book on the circulation of one text, which is not comparative literature. I wasn't comparing it to anything else. It was really a world literature study. So I think you can have overlap like this. There are real studies of world literature that can be entirely translation and about circulation, and there are real studies of comparison that can be two things, one in French and one in German. There are still great comparisons to do, and there can be things in between like this, and that should be an ongoing strengthening of the relations between the two modes of work.
Strikes me that your thesis is almost the opposite, that you want courses to be taught where we almost forget that there's a translator there, that we are dabbling in all of these literatures, and that we are ignoring, in a good way, the role of the translator.
Oh, quite the contrary. Meant to show certain the case of Las Casas and John Phillips, the translator's role becomes now visible in a very serious way. We simply should not use the translator versus not translator as the means of exclusion of the translated works. It's rather bringing them in on an equal plane with the original language works, or in whatever proportion is appropriate. In a given literary culture, it may be dominated by translations, or it may be a smaller proportion of translation. American literary culture has less translation now than it had in the 50s, for example. So the course in American literature in 2010 would have fewer foreign works than American literature in 1955 would have, for example. So that's a varying role. But I see it very much as then thinking actively about the role of the translator. Not only the translator, but to go by the material of the book, the publisher, the editor, the ways it circulates, how it is given meaning, the paratext, all those things become really interesting, and also connected then the history of the book aspect of studying the American literature by Americans in English or the Australian literature by Australians in English and so on. So yeah, I think it should absolutely be playing up the role of the translator.
So in your ideal world literature curriculum, you would actually include critical analysis, not just of translation theory, but of actual translation.
And actually, in the anthology, we show that, right. Mm-hmm. And so we'll give, of course, you have all the really interesting cases. My favorite one with what I... So I give an Aztec poem, for example... in one translation of my own and in one somebody else's translation. And what difference does it even make if you follow the manuscript and set the stanzas simply in paragraph form or if you break it up to look like a European lyric? That's a translational choice material in how it looks on the page. And you can make an argument either way. And I'm often saying, at least to some degree, students should see that if you look at three translations, even if a few paragraphs, you get a much better sense. Even to understand the one you then pick primarily. I mean, life is short. You're going to read 1,001 Nights. You're not going to actually read three whole separate translations. But if you read enough to get a sense of it, now I can sort of correct for or at least understand the tendencies of the given translator. So with these passages, and just with the paragraph in three versions, and then we have a bunch of questions, why have they chosen what they've chosen? Those kinds of things we ask. And I think it's very interesting already for undergraduates. And of course, for the graduate students at that level, it then becomes more translation theory. Can be more explicit.
Yeah, I wonder about how to deal with these texts in translation with monolingual students, because I think you said nice things about the multiculturalism of Australia,
right.
But English is an incredibly dominant public language in our culture, and I deal regularly with students who don't make a categorical distinction between English and language. How does this, and I do occasionally use different translations to try, when I get the opportunity to try and illustrate this point,
It says, you know, I think it's, it, I mean, in a way, it reaches its most serious point with the monolingual students or with the monolingual professor or the professor who doesn't know the language in question, because then you're actually forced to, if you use, the question is using translations critically in a self-aware manner when you can't check the original. But that, in fact, is totally doable, right? So it really does mean, in the ideal world, you might have two variant translations, and you can look even at a page of that. But even without that, you know, the more one, once one starts to think about it, we can say, all right, what choices have they made? And in terms of the things we think about translation theory, you know, how far is this foreignizing? How far is it assimilating? How is it being framed? What's the introduction tell us? What does the book jackets tell us? I've been very interested. I've been recently looking at translations in the United States of Tahar Ben Jalloun from French, and just showing students the paratext, the covers, the book jackets, and then the translators' notes. If there are notes, what are they choosing to annotate? It's amazingly revealing. Just with a few pages, just actually talk about if are there notes or not. If they're not notes, they have to do something to represent the material that won't flow easily. And you should be able to show that. If there are notes, then the notes give a whole politics. So I think it's really, really striking. And you know, and you get the sort of back and forth by authors about this. I remember Orhan Pamuk remarking with some frustration that when Proust writes about love, people think Proust is writing about a universal experience. And when Orhan writes about love, they think he's writing about Turkey. And he's very resistant to his translators including any Turkish words, even when there are, you know, terms that just, you know, foods and so on, that there's not an equivalent. And I was talking about this with one of his translators. He said, well, you know, get real. You know, the market, what people want a sense of the Turkishness. And, you know, he's kidding himself if he doesn't think. In fact, he does know that's so important, right? So I think any given translation gives us ways to think about that, you know, how much Turkishness survives in My Name is Red or in Snow, and in what way has a translation done that? And what is the relation of local reference or of reference to the national tradition to Pamuk's use of reference to Proust or Georges Perec or something? So at all kinds of levels, quite apart from the directly linguistic one, there's sort of the issues of cultural translation also are absolutely fascinating and help, I think, students to get a sense of the full three-dimensionality of what's going on culturally as well as linguistically in what they're reading.
I don't have this point very clear in my mind yet, but I just noticed that you mentioned the Arabian Nights, or the Thousand and One Nights, rather. And
that itself is an interesting question of translation. The Hazar Afsana, yeah.
In the 8th century.
Right.
It was then transformed within Arabic culture. It then went into European culture. And when you're studying or teaching such a work, you end up with a text which has no author, which has no date, which has no culture, which is an Eastern work which came into prominence in Europe and the West. And it's like a living paradox of the unteachable and unexaminable text, because it has none of the pegs we can attach a text to.
That's why it's my favorite text to teach.
Yes.
I'm teaching it to Chinese students in Beijing next week, a session devoted to those translations. Now, it's absolutely fascinating because, you know, it is where all those clever things that before I was in recovery from, you know, post-structuralism, we used to say the most sophisticated theory was about the death of the author. Well, here you've got one, you know, where there's not an author, and you have, in fact, a scene that's entirely of interpretation. And the only embarrassment for the old post-structuralist, the old deconstruction thing, it's actually incredibly expensive. It gains in translation time after time after time. Rather than a disadvantage of a loss of an original, there's a gain of exfoliating versions that are inherent to the dynamic of the frame tale itself, right? The book is staving off death every time. It adds another story, just like Shahrazad. It's absolutely perfect. not only does it gain in translation, it loses in the original, since the Hazar Afsana was not treated seriously enough to be preserved. So the Persian collection simply disappears from memory, and only in translation or adaptation, increasingly expansive Arabic adaptations does it survive, and then goes into Galland in the first and second decade of the 18th century. And then, of course, you have this fascinating biofeedback where it becomes serious literature in Europe and then becomes serious literature in the Arab world, so that people like Naguib Mahfouz or Pamuk will take it, or Asir Jabbar will take it seriously in a way that no one would have done before. And you have increasingly also this fact that, you know, Galland adds in stories of his own. Some of those famous stories never appeared before. They now appear in Arabic edition translated from French back into the Arabic original, right? Because he claimed to have heard them from orally, from storytellers, and Burton did the same thing. And, you know, so you have that. So it's absolutely a perfect playground for these very processes. And I teach it along. I'm giving my students in Beijing the Borges' great essay from 39 on the translators of the 1001 Nights, in which she, you know, praises Burton against the scandalous decorum of the more sober, careful translators. And I have some pages about it in my How to Read World Literature book from a couple years ago, in which I'm not exactly... I'm not saying you would ever want to read only Burton. He's so flamboyant and so bizarre and so orientalist and so sexually obsessed and, you know, all these things. Although that's a reason to read him, but it's so over the top. But the more recent translations, I talk about the more recent English translations by Hussein Hadawi, which is the Norton one, and also N.J. Dawood, which is the Penguin one. These are Iraqi-born translators. One makes his career in England, one in America. And they're deeply offended by the old Orientalist fantasizing of Burton and the prudery of Edward Lane before him, beginning of the Victorian period. But they themselves produce trim, prim, realistic. They're assimilating it to the early novels of Naguib Mahfouz, whereas Burton actually loves the kind of the saja, the rhyme prose of the Arabic. He really tries to get that. He invents an insane English that will give you a feel for what he thinks is going on in the Arabic, which Lane and Dawood don't even try to do. Dawood even leaves out most of the poetry. Hadawi leaves out the end of the frame tale because he's so concerned to get to any original, some original. He goes to a Syrian manuscript that doesn't have the end of the frame tale, so he doesn't have the end of the frame tale. Can you imagine? He kills Shahrazad off silently. What a thing to do. He says a footnote in which he says, "The reader may miss Shahrazad, and I miss her too." Well, the translator has not done such a favor by getting an original sort of damped down to that. So I think it's absolutely a perfect test case for things gaining in the original. And the need to think critically, and not just, to subscribe to Burton's Orientalism, but also to realize he's actually trying to get at something in the prose style that the more careful, sober people who followed him are not doing.
Have you looked at the Lyons translation?
Which one? No, I should.
Translation of the Bulak edition.
Oh, that's great. I should look at that.
That's the only kind of verbatim complete English translation now, if you set aside Burton, which is more synchronous.
Yeah, I'll definitely want to do that, yeah.
There'll be an opportunity to continue this discussion with David tomorrow afternoon in the final session. Any more questions now?
Thank you so much for these very good questions.